Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Hollywood Podcast, covering the latest in film, TV, streaming, and social media. I'm your host, Max Geschwind. Stay tuned for today's episode.
I'm so excited to be joined today by Neil Corbould and Jeff Sutherland. Neil is a two-time Oscar-winning VFX artist who previously won for Gladiator and Gravity, also nominated for Superman Returns, Snow White and the Huntsman, and Rogue One. And this year, he has the unique status of not just being nominated for his work in Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part One, but also receiving two additional nominations on top of that for The Creator and Napoleon as well. So he takes up three out of the five slots in the visual effects category this year, which is definitely a historic and a very impressive feat. We're also joined by Jeff Sutherland, who has earned his first Oscar nomination for his work on the film after a career of working on some of the biggest blockbuster films like the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, Transformers, Iron Man, Star Trek, Avengers, Jurassic World, The Last Jedi, A Quiet Place, and No Time to Die. Thank you both for taking the time to chat with me.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
So with the Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part One, it definitely acts as the first part to a two-part event type climactic finale for this decades-long franchise. However, you never know, there could be more after Dead Reckoning Part Two. But it definitely seemed like it had a result on the action sequences and being performed on a larger scale with greater intensity and thrill. Neil, I'd love to start with you because you previously worked on Fallout. Did you realize very quickly after coming on board the, greater level of intensity to these action sequences in Reckoning than you had experienced on Fallout?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Fallout was a tough one to follow, and you know, you sort of rack your brains of where do you go from there? But obviously, you know, Tom and Chris McHugh came up with these quite big sequences that they wanted to fit into the movie. You know, the bike jump and the train sequence and the Fiat 500. There were some other sequences that they were talking about, but we whittled it down to these sort of big sequences. So you know, it was one of those things. You know, the train especially was one of those big things that they wanted to crash a train off of a bridge, you know, and it's so, and it had to be a steam train. So it's like you can't just go out and buy a steam train and then crash it off a bridge. So, you know, it sort of it got the mind thinking of how we were going to do it.
Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this was your first collaboration with Christopher McQuarrie, the director.
Yeah, that's right.
Could you talk a little bit about what those initial conversations were like between the two of you when you came on board and what that relationship was like in general working with him?
I mean, working with him was great. I mean, he, you know, he has a really great eye for, you know, for detail, for the images, you know, which really helped guide us kind of putting together the shots. You know, he kind of has a real sense for kind of what the audience is paying attention to, where they're looking in the frame, what, you know, and kind of where to put the effort into the shots, really. So kind of, you know, looking at the stuff with him was like, you know, a little bit like going to film school every day. But yeah, it was a really great relationship, I think.
I read somewhere that Christopher, I guess, as a filmmaker, has always been skeptical of effects. How was that trust built to allow you guys to do the work necessary to do, you know, with these action sequences that require visual effects? Did you find that there was a balance there, balancing, you know, the work that you guys needed to do versus the skepticism that Christopher always had for effects?
Oh, well, I would say, I mean, the biggest effect that had was, you know, essentially that almost every shot started with, you know, the photography, what he was able to capture on camera. A lot of times what a lot of directors might leave solely to digital effects, you know, he started with the, you know, really grounded photography, which really kind of helped, you know, like I said, guide our work. It kind of grounded all the physics of the shots into reality. In a way that, you know, that you don't always get in everyone's approaches to making films. And I think that also kind of worked, you know, really, we worked really well with this, like Neil's special effects practical team as well. So, you know, he would get as much as he could in camera with the help of, you know, Neil's, you know, big, large scale practical builds. And then that, you know, for example, like in the train sequence, you know, there were, you know, very large practical rigs that could be tilted up 90 degrees as the train cars were tilting off the end of the broken bridge. And that was a platform that the actors could perform the stunts on. And then all we needed to do was kind of flesh out the image after that. I don't know, Neil can maybe speak a little bit more to that side of things.
Yeah, I mean, we had a sort of very detailed previs that we had to sort of follow. So, you know, it was really designing the rigs around the previs to make sure that we could get the camera in the right place at the right height with the actors in shot, with the train doing, you know, sometimes we had full carriages, sometimes we just had the ends of the carriages where they were jumping from one to the other. It was, you know, I think we had 9 rigs to do that train sequence. And they're not small rigs. They were all sort of, you know, full-size train carriages that we built lightweight that went on the 3-axis gimbal and the vertical set. And then we had decoupling rigs. So we actually did the decoupling of the train actually on the railway track in Norway. So we were dealing with real trains, but had to make it safe for the actors and the filming of it.
That was an unbelievable sequence at the end with the train. I don't think I remember a greater time that I was more at the edge of my seat and having a greater sense of suspense than seeing that unfold over the course of what I'm sure was just like a, what, 5-10 minute scene, but it felt like an hour because you're just sweating, hoping that they're going to be okay. I want to touch on the mask reveal. It's probably one of the coolest parts of any Mission Impossible film. Can you share how technology may have advanced since the last Mission Impossible film that made the mask reveals in this one look different, perhaps more realistic?
So, I mean, it's funny because all those mask shots, there's, you know, there's kind of a series of different ones throughout the movie. And they're not really all the same thing. You kind of think about them in the same way because to some extent they're a surprise to the viewer. You don't necessarily see it coming, or you don't, you know. But like what's actually happening in each one can be a little bit different from, you know, from shot to shot, which is, you know, which basically means that everyone has their own sort of unique approach in a lot of ways. And I would say, you know, for example, an example of that would be, I mean, there's actually a shot where, you know, Hayley Atwell is putting a mask on as opposed to ripping one off in kind of the traditional way. And for a shot like that, it's actually kind of a mix of new technologies and, you know, various digital approaches and, you know, little bits of performance manipulation, that sort of thing. But it's also kind of a mix of old school kind of sleight of hand kind of magic tricks. You're not looking there, you know, that something's happening over here when you're looking over there, that kind of thing. So that it's and that shot in particular was quite a long shot, especially for one of these mask pull shots or mask put on shot in this case. And it was like, I think it was about 3 or 4 plates stitched together, background shots, kind of all stitched together in you know, different kinds of ways. And then, you know, you saw the mask sitting in the box before she puts it on, the mask of Vanessa Kirby. And then you kind of, you know, you tilt up onto her, they take the mask out of the box and put it on her face. And there's a lot of sleight of hand going on there. Then a lot of just kind of artists getting in there, rolling up their sleeves and kind of doing what it takes to make it work, essentially.
Yeah. Neil, did you have anything to add about the mask reveals?
No, that was very much a visual effects thing. We didn't get involved with that one as a practical effect.
Yeah. How integral was Tom in the conversations that he had with the both of you on the VFX of the film? I know, Neil, you had worked with him before. Jeff, I believe this is your first time that you worked with Tom. So, if each of you can talk about your working relationship with him on this film.
Yeah, I mean, Tom's very involved with everything from day one. You know, all the initial conversations are with Tom and McHugh. So, you know, he knows everyone's job. You know, you can't put one over on Tom at all, just because, He's such a clever man, such a talented person. And to do all those sort of stunts and act at the same time is sort of, beyond me. He's just he's sort of the action, the last action hero, if you like.
And Jeff, for you, first time working with him?
I was focused mainly on the post-production side of things, and during post-production of this movie, he was actually starting to shoot the next movie. So my kind of time with him was pretty limited. It kind of limited to reviewing shots, really, on a handful of occasions, and just him looking at our work, giving his feedback, kind of weighing in, that sort of thing. But most of the time, he was out on set, and I was working. He was out on set working on the next movie while I was kind of working on the last movie in post.
Could you both touch on what I think is next to the train scene, one of the most intense action sequences, which was the car chase scene with Tom and Haley, the Fiat 500 or Fiat. Can you touch on what some of your influences were in orchestrating that very high pressure, high intensity action sequence?
From our side, it was very early on they wanted a Fiat 500, and they're very unreliable. So from our side, it was taking the Fiat 500 and putting a bigger engine in it. We sort of probably overspec'd it a bit because we put a 500 brake horsepower electric motor in it, electric car motor in it. And when we first got in it, it was quite frightening. But Wade Eastwood did a lot of testing with it to make sure that it was safe for Tom. And then once Tom got in it, it had a life of its own. It almost became a character in the movie, just because so none of that footage is sped up. It's actually that's how fast that little car went. You'd probably beat a Lamborghini off the line for the first 0 to 60, no
Yeah.
problem at all.
Yeah, and from our point of view in post, it was funny that the one of the ways in which it became kind of a character in the movie is it kind of felt rickety in a way. Like a lot of times, like the hood was bouncing up and down, and the doors were kind of like bouncing in and out. And of course, Chris McQuarrie would cover the whole thing with cameras as well to get the performances of the actors inside. So a big part of our job was, getting rid of the camera rigs, and so we had digital versions of the Fiat that we would sort of like use to patch in areas of it, or occasionally replace it entirely, that sort of thing. But it was really difficult because it was flexing all over the place, and to kind of get things to line up, we built several versions of it digitally, just like I think Neil built several versions of it in reality to kind of be able to address those shots.
Before I close out, I do want to touch on the Oscar nominations. Neil, I'll start with you because, as I mentioned, I think this is the first time that we have VFX artists nominated in three of the five slots. If you could, I know you've been nominated several times before, but if you could just touch on the unique significance that this year has on you in taking up three of the five slots and sharing how this feels in contrast to the several times you've been nominated in the past.
It's quite unbelievable, really. I'm still sort of in shock of it all. It's sort of mainly due to COVID and the delayed release of certain movies, and Ridley Scott shooting very, very quickly and getting movies out very quick. But yeah, no, I'm very honored. I'm proud to be nominated three times. Knowing my luck, I won't win because it'd be sod's law,
You never know. Three out of five, I mean, that increases your odds from 20% to 60% chance of winning. So those are good odds.
Could split the vote, though. Could split the vote.
It could. Jeff, I think I was so surprised when I realized that this was your first Oscar nomination, given your amazing body of work over the years. If you could just touch on what it was like for you that morning or that evening, depending on where you are receiving that news that you had been nominated.
Yeah, it was a big surprise in a lot of ways, just because, I mean, not least of which is I kind of lost track because of the time differences of when it was being announced. So it was kind of just dropped on me by a friend of mine, and he's like congratulating me. I was like, oh, for what? Oh yeah, that came out already. I thought that wasn't going to happen for another 4 hours, that kind of thing. So that was kind of a cool surprise in a way. But yeah, I mean, it's it's a huge honor to be nominated. And yeah, it has been a while. I haven't, haven't had this honor yet, so it does feel good. I'm trying to enjoy it along the way. Win or lose, I think it's about enjoying the ride, I think.
Yeah, definitely. As they say, like nomination is the win, you know? So that's amazing. Do we have any upcoming projects though that we have to look forward to from you?
For me, I'm concentrating on Mission Impossible 8 now, the Dead Reckoning Part 2, and that's kind of all encompassing for me right now. So yeah, I'm not sure what's up for me next after that, but it's all about Mission Impossible these days.
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, like Dead Reckoning Part 1 serves as this first part to this two-part sense of finality with the franchise. Can you offer us a hint on what we have to look forward to in the VFX work in part two? I would expect just a greater level of intensity and in this next installment.
Yeah, Tom definitely likes to ratchet it up, and I would say from what we're, what we've been working on so far, he's definitely succeeding in doing that. It's some of the stuff he's doing is pretty insane. I have to leave it at that.
But what you're saying is he's topping the death-defying motorcycle jump that he did in the first part. He's gonna top even that.
I would say so, yes.
Yeah. Wow. Well, n and Neil, I have to talk about Gladiator 2. I mean, you're coming back to a story that you worked on over 20 years ago. What was it like returning to working with Ridley, working on this series, and yeah, what we have to expect from your work.
Yeah, no, it's like stepping back in time again. We built the Colosseum again. Big movie. I think it's gonna fulfill everyone's dreams of a great sequel. Bigger, bigger, better, better. That's all I can say, really.
Yeah, and that'll be coming out in November, I think. So,
November, yeah, just in time for the award season. So,
yeah.
fingers crossed.
Yeah. Well, congratulations again to you both on your Oscar nomination, or in the case of Neil, your Oscar nominations. And yeah, best of luck on March 10th.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Please take a moment to subscribe to the Hollywood Podcast for free on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Until next time, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Max Geschwind. Thanks for listening.